This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Here's something both political parties can agree on. The government shutdown is completely unnecessary. I've heard both sides say that. But if you ask Republicans and Democrats about how they could have avoided or how they might end the shutdown, there is very little common ground. And we have only 2 days to go to avoid hitting the so-called debt ceiling, which will effectively end the country's ability to pay its bills and plunge the United States into default for the first time in its history. Both the shutdown and the prospect of not raising the debt ceiling are being felt throughout the economy. If we default, the effects would ripple through the world economy. So how did we get here? How do we move forward? And how are you being affected by the intransigence in Washington? We've asked three of our go-to experts on politics and the economy to take us through all of this. Dr. Michael Bitzer is Associate Professor of Politics and History at Catawba College and resident political pundit for WFAE's political blog, The Party Line. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Dr. Eric Heberleg is Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte and co-author of Classics in Congressional Politics. Are you writing an addendum?
This is not classic.
Thank you for joining us. And Dr. John Connaughton is the Babson Capital Professor of Financial Economics at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for being here as well.
My pleasure.
Where do we stand at this hour? Because it seems to change a little bit moment by moment. Where do we stand?
Well, it looks like we've got a potential deal in the Senate. They're going to have their meetings. The Republicans and the Democrats will have their separate caucus meetings later this morning. It sounds like in the House, the Tea Party hard conservatives are going into open revolt against it. They are not happy with this deal. And, you know, all bets are off. If it passes in the Senate, depending on how it goes there, once it gets ping pong back into the House, things may, you know, change and it has to go back to the Senate. It could be, as Eric described earlier, hot potato for the next couple of days.
So that's about 80 people in the Tea Party revolting?
Between 60 and 80. I mean, if you look at recently, there was a letter signed, authored by Representative Mark Meadows, the 11th District Congressman from North Carolina, who basically laid out the line in the sand that said Obamacare should not be funded.
If I have done the math correctly, 80 people in the 535-member House of Representatives is 15%. What happened to majority rule?
About 10 years ago under Speaker Hastert, they developed what's called the Hastert rule, which is that bills are only brought to the floor if you have a majority of the majority party's support for it. And this has seemed to morph in John Boehner's speakership into bills only come to the floor if they can pass with the majority party's votes alone. And when you have a margin of 17 votes out of 435, that gives you zero margin for error. Any faction of the party can threaten not to support something, and you can't bring it to the floor because they don't want Democratic votes to help pass legislation.
So people keep calling this a constitutional crisis, that we're facing a constitutional crisis. But what we're really facing here is a crisis of the Senate and House rules, which the Senate and House change at will and vote on regularly. Has this always been the case, and why is it suddenly a problem?
It's not even official rules in the case of the Hastert rule. This is just something that they made up. Speaker Boehner can bring anything to the floor at any point, really. He chooses not to because he doesn't want to risk a revolt from the most conservative faction of his party.
And even though people are concerned about this minority within the majority party, for the other 120, 130 Republicans in the House, what they're concerned about is the dynamics back home and the potential of getting primaried from the right come particularly next spring when we start to have the midterm general election, primary elections ramp up. That's their big concern.
We're doing a whole program on this tomorrow. And what you mean is that the districts have been drawn around the country to make them relatively safe for particular party. So if a Democrat holds a seat, it's relatively certain that a Democrat will be reelected to that seat and vice versa with the Republicans. And so they don't have to worry about the other party. All they have to worry about is being primaried by another member of their party who tells the public, you have not towed the party line, and therefore you will not be reelected. And this is really affecting politics across the country.
Well, that and ideological coherency. I mean, within both parties now, you've basically got both parties are like-minded individuals. I mean, the conservatives are within the Republican Party. Liberals, not as much in within the Democratic Party.
But there are more independents now, I believe, than there have ever been. So how do you speak to independents if the Republicans are uber-Republican and the Democrats are uber-Democrats? Who speaks to the vast people in the middle who comprise the
Nobody.
Majority of the
electorate? Nobody. And that's the frustration of independents and one reason why they're expanding, that they look at their two extreme choices and say there's no one who represents my policy view. So they're either acting as swing voters or they basically support one party but don't call themselves Democrats
so
or Republicans.
Are both parties, through their members of Congress and members of state legislatures who are responsible for drawing these districts in most cases, are they shooting themselves in the foot ultimately?
No, if their goal is to retain power, which is what it really is. And jerry-rigging the electoral system to advantage themselves is exactly what they want.
Democrats have been blaming Republicans, John Connaughton, on this crisis. Republicans have been blaming Democrats. If you believe polls, and I do, the popularity of the Republican Party is at an all-time low, and more people, I think the figure last night was 72% or 74% of the American public, blame the Republicans for this. So if we go over the edge on Thursday, if we go into default on Thursday, who are we going to blame?
Well, before I answer that question, I got to stop you for this word default. It's become a popular term.
Okay.
The Democrats have used it, the Republicans have used it, and the media have latched onto it. But if we do not pass the debt ceiling mm-hmm. on the 17th, mm-hmm. and that's not a firm, hard date, by the way. I think everybody needs to understand that. It's kind of an estimate, but let's just say it is a firm, hard date. Then what we have to do is realize that we'll be bringing in less money than we have bills to pay. All right.
So we'll have to pick and choose the bills that we do pay.
We pick and choose the bills. And talking about defaulting on our debt, our $17 trillion of national debt, if we were to choose not to make those interest payments, that's a choice. It's not an absolute that we would default. For example, we bring in about $225 billion a month in tax revenue. Mm-hmm. So we can spend that much money without borrowing another penny. About $20 billion of that, or $20 billion is what our interest payment is on the national debt. So the $225 will easily cover the $20 billion. Now, there are lots of other things that the government, you know, pays for, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, et cetera, down the line, that some of that they're not going to be able to pay for, obviously, because they don't bring in enough money.
But the president of American Express told Scott Pelley on CBS News, and also the head of Blackstone, which is a big company that manages retirement funds, both said that if we don't okay the debt ceiling limit increase on October 17th, it would be catastrophic for the world financial system.
I'm not sure it would be. If we were to default on our debt, I think there's every bit of possibility it would be catastrophic if the choice were made not to make some interest payments on the debt. But again, there's not a lot of difference between what could happen on October 17th to what has been happening for the last 15 days. And that is we're running about 83-84% of the government. In effect, we're probably spending about as much money right now with the government shutdown as we take in. And we are making our debt payments. We are making our interest payments. But we have a large number. The estimate ranges from 400,000 or 500,000 to 800,000 or 900,000 federal employees who are not being paid, and an additional number who are working but are not being paid. But we're probably covering that portion of our government operation with current revenue.
Well, some have said.
By the way, Mike, the deficit. This deficit. this coming year, the fiscal year 2014, which started on October 1st, is not nearly as large as the politicians are making it out
to be. Yes, the debt's going down.
It has been going down. Yeah. Last year it was less than $700 billion. That's our best estimate now. We haven't got all the numbers in, but we're pretty sure it's less than $700 billion. And the CBO estimate, and that, by the way, is a nonpartisan group. It's not Republican or Democrat. They score all legislation for the economic effect. Their estimate for this year, the 2014 deficit, is below $400 billion. So it's the deficit's not nearly as big as what people are making out. So when you think about it, if we're only looking at a $400 billion, not a $1 trillion, but a $400 billion deficit, that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 12% of the expenditures. And so, you know, we'd have to pick and choose. But we're close to being able to pay for government without issuing additional debt. Not the government that we're used to, but certainly we're close to it. So this is a scare tactic that both sides are using. And it's a very unfortunate situation because it's not the reality of what's going to happen on October 17th if we do go over the cliff, which, by the way, I don't think we will.
It's the intersection of economics and politics this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Some have said that unless you are a government employee or applying for a visa or a passport, are a veteran applying for new benefits, receive food through an elderly program, are applying for a government-assisted loan, receive WIC, or are planning to visit a national park, the shutdown is having minimal effect on you. Would you say that is true?
Would I say? I think that's probably true, but I think we minimize the impact. There's sort of this macro-micro impact. The macro impact on the economy is not that great at this point in time, and the evidence from 95 when we shut it down for 17 days, it didn't have that big an effect. That's different from the economic impact it has on individuals. Again, we're talking it's hard to get the exact numbers, but we're talking somewhere between half a million and 800,000 people that are not working, that are furloughed. But there's that equal number who are working but are not being paid. Mm-hmm. There's a difference. They're considered essential, and they are working, air traffic controllers, TSA, et cetera. Those folks are working, but they are not getting paid. So far, the economic effect of that hasn't really hit us. But come today, there'll be missed paychecks, and there'll be more missed paychecks at the end of October.
Doesn't that trickle out into the general economy?
Absolutely.
And doesn't it trickle out into consumer confidence?
But more importantly, the impact on those individuals today, right now, to minimize the fact, say, well, unless you do this, that, or the other thing, you're not impacted. Probably, yeah, that's true. But that misses the fact that people who did good work, who had a job, who did nothing wrong, are now being heavily impacted by this.
This does affect real people. And part of the problem in Washington is when we talk about the size of government, whether you believe the government is there to help you or the government they only hurts people and therefore it should be shrunk to the size of a bathtub. In the end, it is people who work for the government. It's people who make money working for the government and who spend that money in the broad economy. We've been playing chicken with these people and with this whole thing over and over and over again for years. It did not used to be this way. We used to be able to pass budgets and get from point A to point B without shutting everything down. What has changed? Is it all based on the district redistricting and what we talked about a few minutes ago?
I think the redistricting is more of a symptom of the changes than the cause, although it contributes to it. It's really that we've had a sorting of the political parties, that we now have no middle anymore in Congress, no people there to compromise anymore, and not a lot of voters in the middle within either party to give them incentive to compromise. We have a Republican Party that is consistently conservative, and if we look at the congressional voting scores, it's changed pretty dramatically since the 1970s.
Dr. Eric Heberlake here with Dr. Michael Bitzer and Dr. John Connaughton. We will continue in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins in our Spirit Square studio with Dr. Eric Heberlake, professor of political science at UNC Charlotte, Dr. Michael Bitzer, associate professor of political science and history at Catawba College, and Dr. John Connaughton, the Babson Capital professor of financial economics at UNC Charlotte. We're talking about politics and about the economy and what's happening with the shutdown and what may happen on Thursday with the debt ceiling crisis. talk about this. This seems to be coming from the Tea Party. The problems, if you look at them as problems, or the resistance, that, let's use the word resistance, the resistance to Obamacare, the resistance to raising the debt ceiling is coming in large part from the Tea Party, which is a minority faction within the Republican Party, and yet the tail is wagging the dog. Why?
Well, if you look at studies from last year's election, about 19-20% of the electorate identified themselves as a Tea Party supporter.
How many?
19%. Okay. So, but within the Republican Party, they wield a pretty significant voice because they are generally considered to be among the most reliable voters who will show up. Now, part of it is—
Are they really a third party? If this were a parliamentary government, would they be a third party?
I think we have to recognize that both Democrats and Republicans are kind of an umbrella organization,
right,
that they are, that there are different factions within—
I don't see any different factions within the Democratic Party. What are they?
Well, for the very few conservative Southern Democrats like a Kay Hagan, like a Mark Pryor, like a Mary Landrieu from Louisiana, you know, they're a dying breed. It's kind of like liberal Republican Northeast Republicans, Susan Collins from Maine.
Right.
They are shrinking, if not extinct, within their parties right now. But within the Republican Party, you've got social conservatives, you've got fiscal conservatives, you've got national defense conservatives. I mean, it's kind of a hodgepodge of different groups together. And what the Tea Party did in 2009 and 2010 was use the antagonism against everything that basically Barack Obama did as a way to gain influence and power within the party.
Some people, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, within the House, they are much more ideologically cohesive. They are willing to band together and to use their collective voices, even though they're about 60 to 80 within 230 members of the House Republican Party. They can also influence those other House Republicans to say, if you're not with us, you're against us, and you're going to be challenged within the primary. Ted Cruz within the Senate, Mike Lee, others who are, you know, Tea Party adherents in the Senate, they're going to have – they've gotten their voices heard as well.
I think on the unity of the Democratic Party, it looks like they're more than there really is because they have a president to set the message and the rally behind, where the Republicans have to organize themselves without – having to rally behind the president. And I think if President Obama reached an agreement with Speaker Boehner on the budget, say, to cut Medicare and cut Social Security, you'd see the factions in the Democratic Party swing back with a vengeance.
Okay. John, you have said that you don't think we'll go over the edge on October the 17th, that they will vote to raise the debt ceiling and they will not allow us to go into default.
They'll do something. They'll do something to kick the can down the road.
Well, they're going
to
kick the can down the road. That's the present measure on the floor today is to open the government till January 15th and then deal with the debt ceiling by February 15th.
Mm-hmm.
We're becoming great can kickers.
We are good at that. But you know, I think that a little bit of history here I think will be helpful in putting this together. We got a lot closer to this problem in the summer of 2011, and it was really something at that point in time that we had not seen in a generation in terms of this type of negotiation to the edge of the cliff. At the end of the day, they did do something, but in the preceding 2 to 3 weeks, it sent shockwaves through the economy to such an extent that it probably nipped off a stronger recovery in the fall of 2011 that we were expecting that did not happen.
But that didn't happen this time.
It didn't happen.
Why
but
not? Wall Street is just the Dow went up yesterday.
Let me finish.
Okay.
In the fall of 2012, leading up to the end of 2012, there was this dialogue over sequestration / government spending,
right,
and the Bush tax cuts expiring. And we thought, you know, it wasn't going to happen. And all of a sudden, on January 1st, all hell was going to break loose, and you know, we weren't going to pass those taxes and everybody's taxes were going to go up, et cetera, and then on January 2nd, I guess, they did something. So they went to the 11th hour and they did something. So we've had two instances recently with this same makeup Congress at the last minute. Now, if you think about this from a strategic standpoint, from a negotiating strategic standpoint, why would you compromise until you absolutely have to? Why wouldn't you hold out and wait and wait and wait till the other side blinks? And that's basically what's going
this
on.
This all started. Oh, well, before I talk about that, tell me why Wall Street has not reacted negatively yet.
Because I think at this point in time, after having seen this Congress and these two antagonists go at it twice before,
they think they'll
and reach a compromise at the 11th hour, the expectation is that that will happen. However, I will make something really clear. Now, while I say I don't think we're going to default on our debt on October 18th,
right.
If there isn't a deal on October 18th, the market is going to look pretty ugly on the 18th if that doesn't happen.
Okay. The irony here, it seems to me, is that the government shutdown was perpetrated by the Tea Party, who refused to get on board with, I guess, the funding of the government.
Continuing resolution.
Unless Obamacare was killed, and that was never going to happen. They probably knew it was never going to happen. They just wanted to make a statement. The irony here, of course, is that Obamacare went into effect the very day that they shut the government down and seems to be, although there are glitches in the system, the glitches seem to be arising from an overabundance of people wanting to get on it. Now, you can argue with that, I suppose, but going forward, if Obamacare stays in, if the Affordable Care Act stays in, do we have any idea what its impact on the economy may be?
It's hard to say. We've got a lot of mixed signals right now, and I'd be remiss to try to come up with some crystal ball as to what it's going to be. There are some good parts of the program. There are some bad parts of the program. Fundamentally, it does not deal with costs. There are some cost containment measures, but not enough to really change that direction of that arrow that's been going on to where it's becoming an increasingly larger part of GDP. So it's not clear what's going to happen. And I think the experiences, the best we can figure out is the experiences to individuals are going to vary by state. Some folks are going to find their insurance costs less. Others are going to find it costs more, depending on the demographic of the individual and which the geography.
And whether or not the states are on board with their own exchanges.
And some of those work better than others, and the federal one doesn't apparently work very well at all. So, you know, this is really a mixed bag, and it's because of the problems associated with it right now and getting on and people trying to find out information about it, it's not clear what the impact
will be. When you hear the opponents of Obamacare talk about this, and we're only going to talk about Obamacare for a second, but that's because it precipitated the government shutdown, you're hearing what sound to be almost hysterical pronouncements about the danger of Obamacare to the country. Any of that true?
I think their best case to make people believe their predictions has been this last week when people have had all kinds of problems with the initiation of Obamacare, and they've stepped all over their message by shutting the government down and having this battle of the debt at the same time. So we've been talking about the debt and not the message the Republicans probably really want to get through, which is the danger they see in Obamacare.
But the dangers that they see are the government taking over your health care, telling you what you can and cannot do with regard with your doctor, what he can and cannot do for you, et cetera. Most of that seems to be not true, but I don't know. Go ahead.
Like earlier in the show, we talked about the deficit coming down. Last year, it was below $700 billion. This year, it's likely to be below $400 billion. The CBO doesn't do forecasts out 1 or 2 years. They do them out a decade.
Okay.
And what's happening here is that if you look at the CBO forecasts, after this year, the deficits start to rise up again and start to become a concern in 6 or 7 years. And most of that is not as a result of Obamacare per se, but it is health care related, Medicare and Medicaid and Obamacare, which are going to be driving deficits up given the current tax structure and given a stronger recovery than what we've seen so far. So they are looking at, the CBO is using a set of assumptions that say the economy is going to start to grow at 2.5 to 3% in the out years. So that's where the problem is. This is going to not just Obamacare, But health care in this country is going to start to get expensive at the federal level.
And wouldn't it have gotten expensive in the absence of Obamacare?
That's the $64 question. And
wasn't that the argument for having the health care debate in the first place,
right,
that something?
But again,
it's going to become unaffordable. It's going to bankrupt the country.
But Obamacare provided access to health care insurance, but it didn't necessarily deal directly with costs. There are a few cost items in there. We have to be clear about that. But it doesn't deal really with the fundamental costs.
Well, and the Republicans are right, when the Tea Party Republicans are right, maybe the Republicans in general are right, when they say that Obamacare is disastrous because it doesn't deal with this problem, but it doesn't deal with this problem because of the obstacles they put up. Isn't that true?
The additional problem is, from the perspective of the federal budget, is the demographic changes in the country. We're getting older, so that means more people are getting Medicare, getting Social Security, and when that's about 40% of the federal budget,
right,
that's going to drive your budget costs regardless of Obamacare or anything else.
And we're living longer. So, I mean, you know, the associated health care cost with, you know, now living into your 80s, into your 90s, have to be significant.
Let's talk about something else other than Obamacare. Some say that much of the tension between the parties right now and the policies of both parties resides in the old states' rights versus the federal government arguments that led to the Civil War, and which we began to debate before the founding of the country. Is that accurate?
I think it's more fundamental. I think for both political parties, they have a view of how the United States is. One is a view of strict individualism. I mean, it is a belief in the individual. It is a belief that the best that comes out of society is to allow the individual to flourish. On the other hand, there's a belief that we are all in this together, that we have to join together and become one country that makes all of us then better. In my belief, that's the tension that we're ultimately dealing with. And how does government blend into either one of those perspectives, the individual versus the collective?
Others say that a lot of this tension stems from a true hatred of this president from many conservatives. There was a man waving a Confederate flag in front of the White House over the weekend. Ted Cruz and other members of Congress were making questionable statements about the president. Another indication that there are some who simply will not accept the legitimacy of this president because he's an African American?
I don't doubt that there is some of that, but I worked in Congress during the Clinton administration. And remember that, you know, the conservative wing of the Republican Party couldn't stand him either.
Him.
It was all about Vince Foster. So a lot of it is just, you know, whether it's ideological or what it is.
Talk to me about this, because I remember this. And it stymied me when President Clinton was first nominated as the Democratic candidate for the first term. People were crawling out of the woodwork in Arkansas to defame this man. Now, maybe he was a terrible governor. I don't know. Maybe he's a terrible guy. I don't know. But I'd never seen anything like it. And you don't see the reverse. You don't see people demonizing conservatives to that degree. It seems to me. I could be completely wrong.
I suspect they are out there. I suspect, though, it's the vehemence certainly seems different. The media megaphone is different on the conservative side, which makes it resonate more broadly.
Sarah Palin, who has supported the government shutdown, was involved in this weekend's protest of the shutdown. For those who don't remember, Palin once said that a shutdown would allow the American people to realize, quote, how irrelevant the federal government could and should be in our lives. And yet, there she was protesting the shutdown. She wants it both ways, I guess. Not everyone has felt a direct impact of this shutdown. So is she right? Is the government irrelevant in our lives?
Mike, when this first happened on October 1st, when it shut down, I was out of the country. Mm-hmm. And I was a little concerned I was going to get back in, but the air traffic controllers, but they went to work. But I was watching a BBC report on it, which was kind of interesting. And I think this is kind of a sense of what's going on here. They went to Texas State Fair, and they were interviewing conservative Texans. And, of course, they did, you know, 10, 15 seconds of dribble on Texas this, Texas that, how big it was and everything like that. And then they interviewed people, and they're all sitting there saying, shut the government down, shut it down, didn't do anything. Now, the BBC didn't catch this irony, but I sort of did, because I sat there and I watched. This is all at the Texas State Fair. They're all having fun. And, gee, who is it that operates the Texas State Fair? I believe it's government. And I think that that's a part of a problem. I think there are a lot of people, well-intentioned people, who really do not understand the role that government plays in their lives.
It's kind of
the intersection of government and politics today on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to say it's kind of like the signs that you see, keep the government's hands off my Medicare.
Yes.
I mean, it's just a complete divorcement of where things come from,
right, well,
and
why,
how they have
why
influence.
Why is that? Is that because we have decreased in the public schools today civics?
No, it's you go back in public opinion polls since we've been taking them. People have always been against big government, but they like the specific things that government does. And there's that disconnect. So they're always going to be for smaller government, lower taxes, and somebody else paying
and somebody
for
else
government.
Paying for it.
Oh, and
my programs.
Yeah, and they don't like deficits at the same time. Like spending, don't like taxes, don't like deficits, but that doesn't add up.
Now, put your headphones on for a second. We'll take a call from Dennis in Mooresville, and I hope you can all hear because we didn't test this out before we started. Dennis, go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Well, I can hear. I just wanted to check in and let you know.
Okay.
And I'm
ahead.
A sustaining member. I'm a sustaining member.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
helping you with the drive this morning. No, I want to keep this brief, and I rarely do. Is it the quickest way to reduce the deficit and virtually eliminate it to A, increase taxes, and B, cut spending? Because these guys, one side says we're not having any new tax increases, and the other side says, well, we're not cutting out anything out of any of these entitlement programs. Wouldn't the fastest way be to do both?
Sure, it would be. And that was the grand bargain 2 years ago between Boehner and Obama. There were elements of both of those in that grand bargain. But when both of those folks, if you read Price of Politics by Bob Woodward, you'll see how that broke down at the last minute. And it probably led to a lot of the animosity that exists today between Boehner and Obama. But what happened was when both went back to try to sell that to the conservative slash liberal wing of their party, it went nowhere. I mean, economists, we all know that, for example, Social Security is an incredibly easy and not painful fix. Medicare is more difficult to fix. Social Security is an incredibly easy fix. A couple of simple things, it's fixed for everybody who's on the earth today. But we won't do it.
Why not?
It is absolutely, people have drawn the line, and they're on one side of that line or they're on the other side of that line, and they have no interest in crossing it.
And we're all 5 years old. Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come right back with more Charlotte Talks on WFAE. And thanks for your call, Dennis. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the current situation in Washington with the government shutdown and the impending debt ceiling crisis that may or may not be one, and the idea that the plan on the table right now is to kick the can down the road so that the government will stay open again until January 15th, and then the debt ceiling will not be addressed until February the 15th. Why? And we're talking about this with Dr. Michael Bitzer, Dr. Eric Heberlich, Dr. John Connaughton. Why do we just keep kicking cans down the road? Why can't we ever in this country today seem to make the big decisions, or any decision for that matter? Why can't we do it?
Because the sides are so far apart, they really don't agree on anything. And even when the leaders, such as the president and the speaker, do agree, they don't have the troops that will support them. to get the votes to pass it through.
What does that say about us?
It says our willingness to put the long-term good of the country and to compromise is less important to them.
Well, let me tell you what other people are saying about us.
Okay.
Because we put ourselves up as the shining city on the hill. I think Ronald Reagan said that. A beacon of democracy, the leader of the free world. And yet here's what they're saying about us around the world. Quote, if this farcical shutdown of the U.S. government were happening in any other country, we would call it a failed state. Failed statehood, after all, amounts to a breakdown of governments to the detriment of the populace as a whole. Would you agree with that?
I mean, Sounds reasonable.
Okay, that comes from the Express Tribune in Pakistan. How can this settled issue of Obamacare now cause the world's greatest economy to flirt with default? In a normal country, it wouldn't. Yet somehow one tiny faction of the opposition party has been allowed to dictate whether the U.S. can even pay its government workers. Washington, D.C. is now the seat of a banana republic. Are there hints of truth in that?
I think the thing that these folks miss, and it goes to the heart of our governing system, is that we don't like concentrated power. And the system is designed to divide power between you, between him, and me, and we all have to play together nicely or nothing gets done.
Right.
That's the beauty of what the Founding Fathers would say makes this system ideal, because you don't have so much power that you can do whatever you want to do, that you have to have compromise in order to get anything done. And what we're having the problem is nobody wants to compromise.
Because they want the power.
Because they want what they want.
Where have we been? Are there historical precedents for this? Has this happened before?
Yes, we shut the government down in 95.
No, I'm not just talking about the government shutdown. I'm talking about the political enmity that just seems to permeate.
Try the 1850s.
All right. That's what I'm getting at.
I mean, you know.
That's what led to the Civil War.
Granted. And if you look at any studies that measured polarization, we have exceeded that span between the two parties more so than right before the Civil War.
The result was the Civil War and the victory of the North over the South, which settled that issue for a century, and now we're back to where we started. So is it going to take a default? Because I don't think we'll fight a civil war. But
again,
is it going to take us plunging the world economy into
I will be
disaster?
Very surprised if we could have this discussion in 2 or 3 days. I think we're going to kick the can down the road. I mean, look, cooler heads
are
going to
have this discussion again in January.
Boehner and Obama do want to fix this thing.
Yeah.
And they've just got to get the stars aligned right in their own parties. And as I said before the show began, and we were just talking around, this is really going to depend on when the Senate votes. I think they're going to vote today, if I'm not mistaken. And if in fact, there's enough Republican votes on the Senate side, it'll probably show up on the House floor and it'll be passed by bipartisan.
It appears now that the House is going to move their own version of the bill and basically discount what the Senate is going to toss over to them.
So once again,
we've got impasse. We've got one House wanting to do something. The other chamber is wanting to do something. They're not willing to talk together.
If we had a Tip O'Neill, if we had a Ronald Reagan, if we had an LBJ in the White House right now, would things be different?
No. The political system is much more polarized. I think if you depend on the skill of any particular political leader, that doesn't get you away from the basic structure that we're looking at here. Obama's been very much criticized for not taking enough Republicans out to dinner. That might be nice. It strokes their ego in Washington, makes the Washington Post feel better. I doubt it makes any difference at all in the policies we're
But even Robert Pittenger, today. Robert Pittenger, who's a Republican House member from
the
Ninth District, told me that one of the problems with Washington today is that everybody goes home on the weekends. And so they don't stay in Washington. They don't socialize together. Mm-hmm. They don't get to know each other. Republicans and Democrats only see each other on the floor where they fight. There's no realization of you, my opposition,
right,
as a human being. Isn't that part of the problem?
I think it exacerbates the incivility. I'm not sure it makes any difference in terms of the policy outcomes because they are so far apart on what they believe and what their constituents back home in their safe districts believe.
Yeah, I think the previous caller, the caller we had, who said if we just raise taxes a little and cut spending a little, this all goes away. And you're right. The solutions to what we're dealing with here the compromise solutions are relatively painless. They're not big swings at this issue. But there's such polarization, we can't even agree to some incredibly simple, virtually painless fixes for like Social Security.
Well, and what each side wants and expects is that the next election is going to solve this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That if they frame this right, if they run the right election campaign, their side's going to win overwhelmingly and they can impose the solution they want without compromise. But I think they're both wrong. Well, the people are ambivalent about it. They keep electing divided government.
But you look at the last election, which was about – a lot of the conversation was about the Affordable Care Act. They reelected the president. Mm-hmm. That was his signature piece of legislation, and yet they still want to get rid of it. Well, I can understand why they still want to get rid of it, but elections don't settle anything anymore.
Because there's always the next one.
Well, they settle it if one side has all the power.
Right.
And we rarely have that in the last generation in American politics. And when we do, it doesn't last because there are extreme parties. They overreach and
so,
they get
booted out. Look at 09 and 10.
I mean,
when you have an unfavorable relationship with the Republican Party, in other words, the polls yesterday, 74% of people blame the Republicans and don't like what they're doing. Is that a signal to the Republicans that they better watch out because in the next election they'll start electing Democrats, or will we forget by the next election?
The beauty of this is that within a week after the shutdown is over,
we'll forget.
People will forget how badly some people behaved during this. And so, you know, I don't think they're fearful of what happened after 95 in the shutdown in the 96 elections with the Republicans.
What if it hits them in the pocketbook? What if we do start not paying our bills?
Oh, yeah. If this thing goes over the cliff on Thursday, you're right.
But who's to blame? Because
I think the
president could have defused this by saying, okay, you can take Obamacare and shove it.
No, if it goes over the cliff, if we in fact go over the cliff and we don't, and this goes on for a couple of more weeks and people miss paychecks, government workers miss paychecks, right. I think the Republicans will pay a big price.
Talk to me about government workers, because if the government workers are not being paid. Now, they may get back paid when they come back, most of them will. But if we were to downsize the government to the degree that certain elements in the Republican Party would like that to happen, what would that do to the economy?
Depends on the way you do it. If you downsize like most companies downsize, and that is, you know, attrition. Over time, it's probably going to have minimal effect on the
economy. We can't find jobs for people in the private sector now. So if you have 830,000 government jobs, they're suddenly open.
We don't know that because we didn't get the employment and unemployment report on the first Friday of this month. But that having been said, the economy is picking up. We are gaining back jobs. That's not necessarily the argument that I would concern myself with size of government.
Well, and I think the other element is increasingly over the past generation, many of the people who really work for the government are government contractors. They're not government employees. So I think the broader economic impact of this is going to happen when contractors expect their checks to come from the government and they don't come.
And it's not just that. It's being able to plan. A lot of government contractors have to buy materials and hire people and put them on the payroll. And if they're not certain that the government is always going to come through on their contracts, well, you can't make plans as a business person. You can't plan.
Right. Obviously, every government contractor on October 1st, basically said, we're not purchasing anything else.
Isn't the government
no paper, no ink, no cartridges, no.
And I think that speaks to confidence. And I would defer to John about this, but I think consumer confidence, looking at the fiasco that we've got right now, they're going to say, can anything get done? And the realist probably is going to say, I'm not going to spend.
And that's what happened in summer 2011. In the month and up to and after the cliff then, the debt ceiling argument then, consumer confidence, which had been rising and it looked like, geez, we're ready to go, just took a big hit and really held us back for about a year. We're not sure we're going to see that this time unless it goes past the deadline. Yeah. If it goes past the deadline, all bets are off.
We don't have a lawyer on the panel, but it seems to me that if these private contractors who now do work for the government and buy things and hire employees, et cetera, have contracts that tell them, here's a project you're working on and it started last month, that the government is in breach of contract. Can't they be sued?
I don't know how the contract's written. There may be a contingency in the contract that covers this. Who knows?
Let's put your headphones back on. We'll go back to the phones and to George in Black Mountain. George, welcome. Hello, George. Well, I'm sorry, George, but you missed your opportunity. Let's go to Vince in Mint Hill.
Hey, Mike, how are y'all doing? It's a great panel you have today. I just wanted to speak on compromise and see if I can't get to the truth of this. I had heard that the Congress has been trying since the shutdown to conference between the two houses. And prior to that, prior to the shutdown, there were 16 attempts by the Senate to conference with the House, and every single one of them was blocked either by Cruz or McConnell. And that leads me to feel that this whole thing is orchestrated, that the shutdown came right on the eve of Obamacare. They're trying to push it right to Black Friday, right before November. And I just feel like at no point in time is this a real crisis. It's been manufactured the whole time. And then lastly, I just want to close on this. Starbucks CEO had a great piece out. He said, hey, I'm not going to pretend that it was only that it was both sides that equally caused the problem, but they both equally share the responsibility for bringing us out of it. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Vince.
Couldn't have said it better.
Yeah.
What will this do? If you kick the can down the road with a possible shutdown in January and a possible debt ceiling crisis now in February, what will this do to the Christmas shopping season?
It could have an effect, but if we come up with a program or a compromise that has certain sets of contingencies that have to be met, benchmarks that have to be met going forward for us to get past January 15th and February 15th, if they do that like they did the last time with the sequestration, not pretty, but right. I think consumers will say, yeah, that's the world we live in, and this is going to get resolved. It's going to be ugly. People are going to get hurt, but we can deal with it. The problem really resides in if we push past October 17th. That's really where it can get really, really ugly.
Dysfunction, the topic of the day here on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Jeff emails unlimited campaign contributions from people like the Koch Industries, the Koch brothers, creates Tea Party challenges to GOP incumbents. Tea Party power flows from the Koch brothers and their ilk. Love that word, ilk. What about that? Because we do now have the Supreme Court saying, you know, you can give unlimited amounts of money to these people.
I think the role of money is significant here, in that regardless of whether you have a quality challenger or not, if you fear whether it's the Koch brothers or others pouring unlimited amount of money into your district, that's a threat. And it's the parties that have been doing this, interest groups that have been doing it. Citizens United just makes it easier for everybody to do it.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Brett in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Mike, thank you for taking my call. I have one quick comment and then a question. I'm disappointed nobody ever talks about how Obamacare is dramatically increasing premiums. There's repeated examples of, we all know people now whose premiums are doubling and more than tripling, and nobody seems to want to talk about that. Second, I'd like your panel to talk about how our current primary system serves to perpetuate the divisions in the party.
I have 90 seconds. What's your question? I have 90 seconds.
The question is what can we do to get rid of the primaries?
Okay.
There you go.
Okay. All right. Let's start with the primaries.
You can't. Because each party needs to pick their candidate for the general election. You've got
to
have some process.
They used to do it in smoke-filled rooms. They don't do that anymore. Yeah. Was it better in smoke-filled rooms?
In the sense that, party leaders could pick people who would compromise and weren't just appealing to ideological activists.
Okay. And let's go back to the premiums of Obamacare. Yeah. I think the truth is it depends on what state you're in, how much competition there is, and whether or not it's a state-run exchange.
It depends on the demographics and the geography.
Okay.
Some young males could get health insurance incredibly cheaply. They're going to pay more for it now. Older people used to pay an arm and a leg. If they could get it at all, they didn't. Now they're going to pay less. So it just depends.
According to Doyle McManus, writing in the LA Times, most insiders believe the standoff will end with Obama and Boehner negotiating a face-saving deal to temporarily fund the government and raise the debt ceiling in exchange for commitment to forge the grand bargain by a certain date. Both parties will claim victory, the Tea Party will be furious, and the underlying problems at the heart of the crisis will remain unresolved. Do we all agree with that?
Yes.
Well, you leave us with great hope this morning. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate it.